Chapter 16, To Realize God's Highest Glory Through Our Body. Two wrong conceptions. Is our humanity to be shucked off like a peanut husk in due time? While it is true, believers will discard this earthly tabernacle, which has only been intended as a temporary abode, and we do groan to be clothed upon with our new house from above, yet we shall not discard our humanity. We have been saying that manhood and humanity is a divine conception which had its origin in the mind of God. There is nothing in the scriptures to indicate that God at some future time is going to finish this order of things and replace humanity with an angelic order or some higher creation conceived in his mind. Our humanity is a very noble thing in the divine planning and occupies a very great and high destiny. Even the eternal Son was robed himself in humanity, not merely for a season, but forever, and now sits in the heavenlies in his glorified humanity. While our temporary tabernacle has been made subject to mortality and corruption for the present, yet the hour is coming when we shall put on immortality and incorruption. Then our humanity shall be beyond the powers that now seem to hold it in bondage. The burning question is this: just how much of the redemptive and quickening work of the Spirit is available now for our mortal body? How do we appropriate this work so as... The more one observes how God's children are being pushed like mere pawns, pushed beyond their natural measure of strength, carried along in this mad, rushing tempo of our day, the more one is amazed that there is not more physical, emotional, and mental breakdown. Apparently, these children have not considered what it means to observe his built-in laws or to appropriate divine resources for realizing his highest glory through their bodies. In all this mad rushing and breakdown, God is crowding his children into a place where he might unveil his purpose and his ways for their body. Many are discovering that as long as they are still carving out their own religious kingdoms or promoting the work they would accomplish for him by their own methods, he must allow them to crumble and falter in their own strength. Apart from a very real death to selfish purposes, ambitions, and methods, there can be no understanding or appropriation of that life in the Spirit. God will only supply his energy for his work done in his way. In the heading, we have mentioned two conceptions which need correction. First, our humanity will not be discarded for some higher kind of angelic form. God has planned for a glorified humanity which will express the dignity, beauty, and majesty of his intention. Second, and this will comprise the main subject of this present chapter, we must correct the all too prevailing idea that since man's body is subject to mortality and the bondage of corruption, the very best we can hope for now is to put up with the limitation and eagerly wait for another body. How we use this body or abuse it has not seemed too important. We have considered the fact that God has designed his universal kingdom to function according to built-in laws. In the heavenlies, we have the planets and the constellations following exact laws of their orbit. All around us, there are hundreds of laws in operation. A father was explaining that Newton's law of gravitation held things together. When his son asked, "Well, Daddy, what held things together before they passed this law?" Just as Newton did not pass the law of gravitation, but discovered it, so we do not pass the physical or moral laws written into the constitution of things. We discover them. We must honor these built-in laws just as we have learned to honor the law of gravitation. If not, we shall be broken. We do not break these laws, they break us. God has written into the very structure of our being, into our tissues, our nerve cells, our bloodstream, into the total organization of our life, certain laws which govern our mortal body. Indeed, sin has invaded this little kingdom of our mortal body and sought to upset these laws and the way we are made to live. What is so completely alarming is that so many of God's children seem ignorant of these laws or unconcerned about honoring those they do recognize. Indeed, God has provided a redemption which allows forgiveness because we have broken these laws. But it is surely not a redemption which allows one to continue breaking these laws of our mortal being at our own whim without paying the penalty. In the glorious eighth chapter of Romans, Paul is primarily concerned with how this redemptive and quickening work of the Spirit is to be operative in our mortal body. He unveils a level of spiritual reality which even the most spiritual have hardly grasped or appropriated in their daily living. I know that others have had a glimpse into the life in the Spirit. Therefore, I am not alone in presenting something which seems most revolutionary. There is something far beyond a mere touch from the Lord or claiming a package of healing. There is a moving into that which God originally intended for Adam and his family, even if he had not sinned. One who has most surely known much of this eighth chapter reality has said, "In my lifetime, I have seen so few who knew how to continually abide by God's built-in laws so that they might draw from divine resources to sustain their physical life. Some of these had learned to finish great amounts of work which would exhaust the average individual. Their vitality and rebound so challenged me, I determined to know their secret. It seemed they were free from the strain and anxiety of trying to know God's will, because they knew, and were sure that they knew, they could confidently face impossible obstacles which had swamped other men. Why were they so vibrant with surging life? Watching them created intense longing within me to also share in this flowing stream of his life. Then I realized they had learned the reality of Romans 8. I also realized that what has seemed so extraordinary should actually be normal for every life who would realize God's highest glory through his body. In this brief space, there is too much to cover, but let me enlarge on five little phrases in this eighth chapter and trust they may take on new meaning. 1. Living with no condemnation. 2. Living according to the law of life. 3. Living by the Spirit of life. 4. Living as though our body was dead. 5. Living in that glorious liberty. First, how many really live with no condemnation? I do not mean that we should be free merely from a conscience that condemns, but also from a heart that condemns. To understand the value of Christ's blood as the Father values it is wonderful. By redemption, we understand that his precious blood accomplishes a legal satisfaction. Our conscience will not condemn us. This is very important for the child of God. Yet I believe there is another condemnation which arises from our own heart. John says, "Beloved, if our heart condemn us not, then have we confidence toward God." 1 John 3:21. This gnawing in the inner heart drives men. It is not a question of legal satisfaction, but an assurance of our heart before him. 3:19. There is only one answer for this heart condemnation. Those who are completely identified with his mind and purpose, who have come to live in the eternal perspective where they see both the urgency of opportunity and the urgency of crisis, can know that they are of the truth and have assured hearts. And this is the consolation. God is greater than our heart and knoweth all things. God does more than remove the condemnation of our heart. He gives the spirit of assurance and sonship. This is far more than merely being free from condemnation. There is that inward witness to pleasing God which Enoch enjoyed when he knew he pleased God. What complete harmony and attunement that one day he should walk too far, yes, walk right into the very presence of God. Beloved, be sure of this. Where there is no condemnation, but rather a glorious heart of assurance, it is like being free from all the grit and sand which usually hinders the delicate mechanism of our body. Second, there is much more than we have realized in living according to the law of life. A railway engine is made to run on tracks, and if it remains on the tracks, it finds freedom, pulls its load, and gets to its destination. But if, in order to gain its freedom, it jumps the tracks, the result is not freedom, but ruin to itself, for it has missed the laws of its function. To further illustrate, a little boy had listened attentively as his father explained the natural laws which God had built into the universe. He was especially fascinated with the law of gravity. A few minutes later, as they were walking in the garden, he questioned his father, "Why do those leaves on that plant point up when gravity is surely pulling them downward?" As they stood looking at several plants, the father explained, It's because God has built a higher law of life into that plant, which lifts its leaves upward to the sun. This law is not exactly defying gravity, but in some strange way is transcending that downward pull. You see, this next little plant with one leaf which failed to draw from the plant's resources and has become limp? Therefore, the law of gravity has taken over. Only God really understands how the plant's metabolism lives according to the law of life and thus transcends the law of gravity. The same is true of our bodies. God has designed us to live according to a strange and wonderful law of life, which is not something imposed upon us from without, but is built into our very being. It merely requires that we be yielded to Him as His tender plant. Even as the plant is alive to the sun, so every petal and leaf of our being should continually be living unto Him. When this is so, our whole physical being is transcendently overriding every downward pull. As the law of life is constantly operating within, we are vibrant by sharing divine resources. As surely as our physical turns from its sun, it will surely become limp and succumb to the downward tug. Might we suggest that most failure or breakdown is simply proof that we have not heeded the divine law of life and the resources which become available? Third, we are seeing there is much more provision for living by the spirit of life than we have usually appropriated. Paul insists that God has not given us the law of life as an inward regulating power, but also the spirit of life as an abounding resource. The two will always work together, for they are inseparable. Thus Paul writes, "The law of the spirit of life." We have asked the question, just how much quickening can we appropriate for our mortal bodies? For many, it has seemed easy to excuse themselves from this kind of reality by insisting that this quickening is to be available at the time of the rapture, when we receive our new house from above. But notice, this quickening by His Spirit is for our mortal body, not our immortal body. This is a provision we can enjoy now. Have we not at times had a wee taste of this quickening? We know what it is after an exhausting day of labor to drag our weary body to midweek prayer service. While you were there, something strange happened. You sensed an inward quickening, a flow of His life into your dragging body. By the close of the service, you were renewed. The Spirit of life working according to the law of life had produced a quickening. That which had been limping and dragging suddenly became alive. Like the plant which turns its attention to the sun, so your attention was upon the sun, and that wonderful law of life cooperating with the spirit of life had infused a vitality and vibrancy you could not explain. Now, if God can do this for a couple of hours, can He not do it continuously? Fourth, it is no small thing that God counts our body as dead because of sin. This means that God has looked down the corridor of time to see that sin has already reached its full harvest. Death is that full and final harvest. Thus, when God looked upon His Son hanging on the cross, He reckoned the full harvest of sin and death wrapped up into His dear Son and placed in the tomb. So, when Christ died there, He carried in His body the full harvest. Since God reckons our body dead because of sin, He waits for us to realize this glorious truth and also reckon the same thing. This means that as we have moved through the cross and the tomb into the resurrection life, we have a deliverance from the bondage and calling of the physical. That is, we have this deliverance as we reckon upon the sentence of death on our body and yield to the spirit of life. This means living as though our body was dead. At first glance, I know how strange that statement seems. Some will insist, even though I have reckoned upon my union with His death and resurrection, my body seems very much alive. In fact, its appetites are constantly calling out and becoming very demanding. That may be true, yet as surely as we have reckoned the self-life into its place of death, so we must recognize that our body was also included in this death. We can only reckon as we have new light. Is it not true that there have been those rare hours when the spirit of life seemed to be reigning in such measure that you were lifted out above and beyond the calling of your body, so that you did not even hear or were not responsive to its demanding voice? You were quite surprised that 3 hours had slipped by while you were in prayer, and your knees or physical had not reminded you of any weariness or of any appetite. In those hours, things which had seemed so important were no longer important at all. It is no small thing to become alive unto God and find yourself moved along in a whole new occupation, occupied with Christ Himself. In this union, there is a flowing of life which automatically cuts off the old occupation. Perhaps this will illustrate. One fall, when I decided to rake leaves in our yard, about half of them were still hanging to the oak trees. I could have wished for some way to knock them off so I could rake all the leaves at once. In fact, I seriously considered how I might reach them with a long pole, but they continued to hang there throughout the winter months. In the spring, when the sap began to flow into the branches of the tree, the old leaves quite naturally fell off. Surging life had its own way of cooperating with the law of life. Then God opened my eyes to see His ways. I realized how often we have taken after God's little ones with our poles. We have sought to strip off the dead things from their life, but after we have pretty much stripped them down outwardly and conformed them to our wishes, we still had nothing but a barren tree, seemingly dormant and fruitless. If we can only see that God considers our body as dead, even as the leaves, we shall turn our attention then to the glorious spirit of life which is surging within, working according to the law of life. We shall not need to be occupied with the knocking off or the putting to death of our body. We reckon this as accomplished and become occupied with Him and His surging life. The rest follows automatically. How often have we heard folk announce, as they entered this reality of Romans 8, that it was like the entrance into springtime in their physical being? He who has known even a taste of this needs little explanation. He who is prejudiced or ruled by a carnal mind will accept no amount of explanation. Now we must go on to the last phrase. Fifth, there is much more in this glorious liberty, verse 21, than we have even imagined. How shall we explain this maturity of liberty? Like the wiggling worm which finally bursts forth as a butterfly, we have all rejoiced when some introvert has suddenly been set free from the shackles, inhibitions, and bondages to enjoy the release of their personality. But if that seems great, it is only a small glimmer of that glorious liberty which God intends for all His children. I shall always cherish the remembrance of such a liberation. I recall one afternoon how a staid, queenly Presbyterian grandmother, well beyond 80 years of age, stood and shouted at the top of her voice, "Well, glory! For more than 80 years I have been in this cage, and He's set the bird free." She wept and she laughed. "No one has ever heard me pray aloud, for I have been afraid of my own voice, but now I'm alive unto God instead of others." And with lifted countenance toward Him, she shone with a glory which was the reflection of looking into His lovely face. She was never again the same. The old veneer was removed, and the new personality was released to express His loveliness. If God can liberate such a starchy, reserved old grandmother at 80, surely He can break up any old patterns and veneers which have bound us. Again, there are those who make this liberty to be something mostly future. Indeed, there will come an hour of glorious liberation for which all creation is now groaning and travailing. Yet there is a glorious liberty which is now available. Paul reminds us, "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty." But we all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord, 2 Corinthians 3:17-18. So this change from glory to glory is not something in the distant future. It is even now being wrought in those who move along the highway toward full sonship. Finally, we are saying this liberty is the life of glory. Instead of living merely to burn out, so as to quench that inner gnawing and condemnation, there is a shining forth of His glory, and one has that inward assurance he is pleasing God, even as Enoch. Instead of struggling to keep mere laws, There is a cooperation with the Spirit of life, and the law of life becomes automatic as we become wholly alive unto Him. Instead of frustrated busyness, we become relaxed in His Spirit-directed fruitfulness. Words are utterly inadequate to explain the reality Paul is presenting in this 8th chapter of Romans. Yet the one who has tasted of the quickening of his mortal body by the Spirit will understand that it comes because our heart throbs as one with his heart, and our mind has come into the full harmony with his mind. This is the life of glory. It is the life of continuous union. We have sought to show that as we live in the reality of these five phrases, God realizes his highest glory in our body. Then, because we have not sought any glory for ourselves, but only for him, he is delighted to allow us to share in the spotlight of his glory.
Glory to glory, to glory, to glory, to glory, to glory to God. Glory to glory, to glory, to glory, to glory, to glory to God. To the only God, our Savior, be majesty, dominion, and power forever and ever and ever. Be glorified, yeah.
Good night.